There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. Beyond the Darkness is on the air. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. I have to start the show off on a little bit of a sad note this evening. A regular contributor and frequent guest to our show, J.C. Johnson, a cryptozoologist, has passed away. We had posted prayer and healing requests for him last week. He has been battling with pneumonia and lung infections, and he'd reached out to me a few days prior to his death and just touched base with me on Facebook, and we had a very nice but brief conversation, and the next thing I heard was he had been put into the hospital and put into a medically induced coma the next day. And as we had posted on our site for prayer and healing requests, unfortunately, the update came through from his daughter, and JC lost his battle with the infection that was ravaging his body. So JC had been a friend of our shows for a number of years and a great contributor. He will be deeply missed, and I'm sure at some point in the next month or two when we do a revisited episode, one of our favorite past episodes, we will revisit one of the episodes with J.C. Johnson and just remind you of what a spectacular guest and friend of the show he really was. So please keep his family in your thoughts and prayers as they deal with this loss. I am back from Las Vegas. I had a great time out there. I had a chance to go out for the Super Bowl, have some great times, and I love talking to people out there and bumping into locals, asking them about the strangeness of Nevada and where they're from, what have they witnessed. And, man, there are ghost stories that abound in Las Vegas, UFO sightings, weird creature sightings out in the desert. It is a plethora of stories, and I love getting the chance to meet face-to-face with so many of these people and hear their stories. And one story that, you know, as we're always looking for guests to bring to the show, what are topics that you're interested in? And so many of you love the mysteries and just the strangeness, not always just ghosts or abductions or cryptids, but just kind of the weird strangeness and mysteriousness of all of these different topics. And brought to my attention is our guest that will be joining us this evening, his new book, Reality Denied, confronts conventional wisdom with many events that, while real, seem to challenge the revered laws of science, proving them to be wrong or perhaps incomplete. The thorny issues of life after death, mind over matter, UFOs, remote viewing, telepathic communications with animals, and more are all addressed from a first-hand perspective. And in searching for answers to seemingly intractable questions, readers may discover the importance of how their fundamental beliefs inhibit finding obvious solutions. Here, physical and spiritual domains collide, providing glimpses of worlds many have only dreamed of. Joining us this evening is John B. Alexander, Ph.D. He's a retired senior Army officer with decades of experience with a wide range of phenomena, and he's traveled to all 8 continents. He has encountered events that defy common explanation. It is such a pleasure to have you here with us this evening. John, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Hi, Dave. Glad to be here.
And I'm hoping this is just the start of many visits. I know when you and I were talking off air, you said, Dave, we could probably do an episode on every chapter that you cover in this book, plus so many other experiences you've had throughout your life. I want to know a little bit about you, if you don't mind, to introduce our audience to you. You know, being involved in the military, a lot of people are very standoffish to talk about strange phenomena like you cover in this book. At what point in your life did this become an interest to you?
Very early. In fact, my UFO interest goes back to at least 47. I can remember I went to a very unusual grade school that had a radio system inside, and I was 10 at the time, and the students would get to do radio broadcasts, and I remember doing one of my first ones was on UFOs about the time of the Ken Arnold case.
Interesting. So that was, yeah, that's a very early catalyst for you. And when you hear these kind of things and you remember hearing about this at school, what was the general consensus and feel about stories like this at that time?
Well, most of them begin, as did the revelations from Department of Energy on the experiments that said it was a different time. And it really was. I mean, I can actively remember pieces of World War II, not being in it, but as a young child growing up in there. And as soon as the war was over, everybody figured, well, that's it. But it was very quickly that we understood that the Soviet Union and the Cold War was coming on, and so there's a lot of disconcert about what the Soviets might be able to do, and did they have technologies that we didn't? And so from a global perspective, like I say, it was a different sort of thinking. And, of course, very skeptical in general, I would say, of these anomalous reports. But even as early as 47, you were getting quite a bit of media interest, but it was more of a, gee, isn't that interesting, than, oh, gee, we ought to look at this and take it seriously.
Did you think of it as just, fantasy and fun science fiction of the time, or were you really kind of understanding the depth of the possibilities that were, starting to be spoken about at that time regarding this type of phenomena?
Not consider myself that prescient. I would like to say, wow,
right.
I have all this great forethought, but that's just basically not true. I was going along with the crowd. I was interested and picked up on these topics and followed it. I remember the movies that were just beginning to come along on outer space and aliens and all of that. So it was more of a kind of a generic interest. I often get the question of, was there some event that happened? And I say, no, there was no epiphany. And my career looking at these things has been more like steering a cruise ship or an aircraft carrier that turns slowly as opposed to, precipitous events that, although there have been a number of events, but they have come along in sequence.
When you had your career with the military, were you privy to some of these fringe elements of the world around us, or were they very tight-lipped about this? Was it nearly impossible, unless you were on the higher echelon, to get any kind of information regarding UFOs, cryptids, paranormal, telekinesis, any of that kind of information?
Yeah. I'm not sure quite how to answer. I'll try to be evasive, but
right.
my experience with the various organizations from low levels to high levels is that it varies tremendously based on personalities. And if you have senior people who are interested, as we did with the military stuff, the thing you're probably alluding to, the remote viewing program and the work we did with psychokinesis. But I was a lieutenant colonel by that time. And before that, frankly, I was too busy most of the time to be going off. But in the early 80s, the world was changing dramatically. We were concerned about what the Soviets were doing in the area. You may know I wrote an article called The New Mental Battlefield, which was the first time in a real, military journal that these topics of remote viewing and PK and psychotronics actually appeared. Kind of a fluke, but it was from that that people sort of sought me out, and then I was assigned to the Pentagon, and just person after person became interested. But again, it was very much first-person interest. I'll give you a specific example of how it got to very high levels. I had given, or actually attended, a kind of a psychic conference that was being held there. And the woman running it was the wife of a retired colonel who was the friend of the wife of General Stilwell. And Stilwell at the time was DepSec Dep, or the Deputy Secretary of Defense. And what happened was that through the WIVE channel, the word got passed to the Deputy Secretary of Defense. I mean, I was a lowly lieutenant colonel. I mean, the difference between, we used to moo when we went into the stanchions as lieutenant colonels. You know, there's a joke about the lions that escaped, and one of them got starving and came back, and the other one was later captured, and it was fat. And he says, "What did you do?" He says, I went to the Pentagon and hid out, and I ate a colonel a day, and nobody missed them. So the point was that there was quite a great differential, and Stilwell asked to meet with me, and we talked about a range of topics, including what we thought the Soviets were doing in the area and that. And I was an inspector general for the Army at the time, and I went back to my office. This was about noon, 1 o'clock, and later that afternoon, the executive officer came in and said, "Tomorrow morning, you don't work here anymore." And he had just reached in and moved me, and then I became much more actively involved in these areas on a full-time basis.
So you almost became a Fox Mulder from the X-Files, huh? They kind of saw what you were doing in the groupings that you were being a part of and sought you out.
Well, there were people, again, who were interested, but mm-hmm. I must say the flip side of this is there were people who really did not want this to happen. And as you know, the remote viewing program, for instance, moved from organization to organization, and that was based primarily on the whims of senior leadership. When it was supportive, it was in the Army, and I had to move to DIA. It became unsupportable there, had to move again. There were pros and cons. One of the things I used to say is when I was in the Pentagon, I used to run around looking for this guy who says the Pentagon says this and the Pentagon says that. The Pentagon doesn't say anything. It's a big stone building.
Right.
But there are about 30,000 people in or around there, and they come with 30,000 opinions. And let's say some of them are supportive. We do know that, you know, in the adult population, somewhere between 7 and 10% have actually seen what they believe to be a UFO. And that number holds true in the government as well, both the Pentagon and other segments. So you have people with personal experiences, and then you've got the one of the flaps that we ran into was, it's the work of the devil. You may be able to do that, but we shouldn't for, you know, religious purposes.
When you've decided to start researching, writing, and releasing books like this, did you get any pushback from the military? Did they request a chance to preview what you were going to release before it came out, or how did that work?
That's actually a very funny story. I wrote the article. I was at Command and General Staff College, and it was not too trying. So that's when I wrote The New Mental Battlefield, and I submitted it, and it just, this is where serendipity steps in, but it turned out that the editor of the Military Review at that time had a near-death experience. So he was personally very supportive. So, yes, we sent it off to the Pentagon, and it came back, and there were no objections, and hence the article got published. Not much of a flap until a few months later, Jack Anderson, who was an investigative journalist, well-known at the time, wrote an article called The Voodoo Warriors of the Pentagon. Got the story wrong. But anyway, let me fast forward. The sequel was that later on, and we can get to psychokinesis, but I used to get involved in teaching metal bending. And I was with a group of colonels and whatnot, and was teaching them how to do it. And this guy raises his hand. He says, did you write, that article? I said, yeah, I'm the one. He says, would you like to meet the guy who approved it? It basically had been a mistake and slipped through.
So that was probably shouldn't have ever made its way out. Fascinating stuff. And for our listeners.
It would have been a flap.
Right.
But it is one that, again, the guy just signed off on it. Well, there was another story. This was before I had met with General Stilwell. But and when the article first came out, and this lieutenant colonel came huffing and puffing into my office down, and we were down on the first floor of the Pentagon. And he, same thing, did you write this article? I said, yeah, I did. Why? And he said, well, don't you know the process for getting it cleared? And I said, yeah, that's right. And it just so happens I had the file with me. And he's ranting and raving. I said, well, wait a minute, what about this? And it was from the office that he had was assigned to. Oh, oops.
Yeah.
Whoever the guy was that we met a couple years later was the one who definitely had a bad day.
Well, I wanted for our listeners to know as well just a little bit more of your background. You're retired from Los Alamos National Laboratory. You served on studies with the National Research Council, the Army Science Board, the Council on Foreign Relations, NATO, and was a senior fellow with the DoD University. The head of your doctoral committee was the legendary Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And you also studied at Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, the Sloan School at MIT, and Anderson School at UCLA, recipient of the DOE Nuclear Weapons Program Award of Excellence and the President's Volunteer Action Award. So you're kind of a slacker is what I'm picking up here, Dr. Alexander. Is that it?
Yeah, there were some slow days.
Well, I love to be able to share that kind of background for our listeners. So when they're wondering, well, where does this guy come from? Where is this? And you start to hear the stories, they can realize just what kind of gentleman we're speaking with. Again, this isn't somebody on the fringe element of the government or somebody with an axe to grind or bone. You've got some meat to this story. You've been there. You've been in a lot of these situations to know and see things. And that's fascinating to me. Now, one of the stories that we talked about off air that I really asked if we could delve into for tonight's episode, I know we're going to talk a little bit about a UFO encounter a little later. But one of the stories was in dealing with the Skinwalker Ranch. And that has been something we did an episode on back in 2006 with one of the authors of the book. Colm Kelleher, and it was fascinating. And I know we've reached out to George Knapp, who said, you know what, I that story has been done, and our listeners want more and some information and background on this. Now, the Colm Kelleher book was certainly gripping and intriguing, but can you walk us through a little bit? What was your experience with the Skinwalker Ranch, Dr. Alexander?
Well, it's sort of mixed. I was with Bob Bigelow the day that he actually bought the ranch, and so it was the first one from NIDS to spend the night there up on the ridge. Mostly what I got was a lot of mosquito bites.
Could you tell us, for listeners that are not familiar with the Skinwalker Ranch, first of all, when Bigelow purchased this property, was it because there was anomalous activity taking place there, or was the purchase made and then the anomalous activity made itself known, and how did that all unfold?
I don't know. This area has been known for decades, if not centuries, to local people. Natives in the area do avoid it, particularly at night. By the way, it never was Skinwalker Ranch while we were there. That was a name that got attached based on Native American folklore. Kind of, I think, after NIDS, left. But it has become popularized, of course. We did know that there was a guy, his real name is now known as Terry Sherman, and his wife owned the ranch. I'm not exactly sure how Bob initially got in contact with him, but he had just any number of phenomenal events that were happening, some of it with cattle. Now, this people also fail to recognize that this is and always has been a working ranch. So it became a laboratory, but it had definitely ranch duties throughout. But what Terry had noticed is that many of the incidents that happened seemed to happen to his prize cattle. And it was really of concern and economic survival because of the problems that happened. He decided to sell. There was an incident, I think it's in, I don't know if I wrote it up, or I'm sure Colum and George Knapp did. Again, one of the things to remember is there is such a variety of different phenomena that exist here that it's kind of almost hard to comprehend. There's not a single thing. But specifically, they had had some dogs, and he had young teenage children, and so there were these blue orbs that came floating in, kind of just above head level. And this particular incident, the dogs kept jumping up and yapping, and trying to bite at these orbs as they dance around. And they kept moving further and further to east, and the dogs kind of followed them. And then they disappeared, and they never returned, which was quite unusual. I mean, having the dogs run off throughout the ranch, that was not unusual. Not returning, particularly for food, was. But he went out the next day, and what he found were three greasy spots that he thinks were the dogs, that something nefarious had happened to them.
Wow.
And they're
three. Wait, now just so people understand what you just said, he found three greasy spots that he thought had at one time been the dogs.
His interpretation is this is what was left of his dogs. That they had, in interacting with these orbs, had been zapped, disintegrated, emulsified, and that was what was left. Now, their concern was that the teenagers might get similarly enamored or have interactions with the these bulbs, or we call them orbs, of course, and there's various types, but these were kind of blue ones floating around, and was concerned that the children might take after them and have a similar experience. So it was at that point he opted to sell and get out.
When you were there, did you witness, we've heard accounts from strange portals appearing to creatures roaming the land that don't look like anything else anybody's ever seen, to UFO encounters, ghostly voices, knockings, electronic disturbances. Can you confirm or deny any of that information?
I'd say all true. Now, let me explain a couple of things. First of all, when the ranch was initially active with NIDS, these things did happen over a period of 6 years. I had kind of a shootout with Jesse Ventura. He said, yeah, people want to go up there or not. This is not something that happened like on a nightly basis, but these extreme events did occur. What I can say is none of them happened to me personally. One of the things we did note, there's an astrophysicist who works, you know, for Hal Puthoff, that's Eric Davis, who appeared to be more sensitive to some of these phenomena, and that when he was there, things happened. He, for instance, there's an old dilapidated ranch house, almost completely demolished over time, out, and, well, I might describe the ranch, and maybe that helps. Understand that most of it is perfectly flat, and then there's an escarpment to the north that rises a couple of hundred feet, and most of the area is open, but as you get farther to the west, there's a lot of Russian olives, and there's a couple of creeks that run through in different places. And out near where this old house was an area where the huge Russian olives were. And what happened is they were out there one night. Now, again, I was not present at the time, so I'm reporting secondhand, but know Eric pretty well. And again, a PhD astrophysicist-level kind of guy. And they noticed something sort of moving through the trees. And their description was kind of like the movie Predator, where, you know, you couldn't actually see it. It would just see a disturbance as it moved. And Eric is the one who got the telepathic message that says, "We are watching you." And again, there were several times when Eric would have premonitions about things that were happening or sentient experiences around the, well, out in the field as well as back at the, they had moved a double wide trailer in, is where they spent most of the time.
The stories are so unbelievable, and it's so rich with this, as you said, kind of history and Native American lore surrounding this property. Now, NIDS was in there for how long?
6 years.
And after they left, what happened? I mean, who's in control of the property at this point?
Well, 6 years, you know, Bob Bigelow owned the ranch up until a year or so ago. I'm not sure exactly when it was sold. So it was still, you know, under his ownership. And again, a working ranch. And I'm not sure who is there now. I do know that the individual is not interested in visitor, although I did have a friend recently who had pulled up to the gate. He was an investigative reporter and went up there and pulled up to the gate, was standing there looking, and some guards came along and invited him in and let them look around. But that is not the norm. Most of the time, the people you hear about, you know, go particularly to the south. There's a major road to the south where you can see up into the ranch area, and people park out there. But
you didn't personally have any real anomalous experiences.
No, I did not. Although I am totally convinced of the physical evidence that supports some of these strange events. And again, some of these came from stories from a third party. Others were our own investigators who spent time on the ranch. We used to do a lot of night watches, if you will. And, the other thing was that it was instrumented. So we had, for instance, video cameras that were running certain areas of the ranch 24/7, doing time-lapse photography. and had things that, most interestingly, some things that absolutely happened and yet do not appear on cameras that should have observed the incident.
So it was in the visual spectrum, you could see it, but it was not magnetically recorded on any of the cameras.
No, you could not see it in the visual spectrum, but physical damage was done.
Oh, so much, again, like the Predator, that kind of, you couldn't see it, but there was something there doing kind of damage.
I'll give you a specific example.
Please.
And again, the first chapter of my book, by the way, is specifically on events from Skinwalker. But what happened is we had, as I said, we had this thing instrumented, and you had a series of cameras mounted on 20-foot poles, oriented to the west, and again, time-lapse photography. About half a roll of duct tape that held the wires to it went up to the cameras that were, again, located on a platform, came down, went through to protect them, and went through PVC U-clamps to mount it to the pole itself, then underground back to the cabin and trailer, actually. And these are being recorded on time lapse, but date time stamped, so you know exactly when things happened. And this particular major event that I'll describe, if you want, is that they came in one morning and they found that the wires that were connecting to one of the cameras had been pulled loose. And we know exactly when that happened because, again, you look through the videotape and you know when it stopped. But not only was that pulled loose, that, as I mentioned, half a roll of duct tape that held everything to the pole was gone. The PVC that I mentioned with U-clamps was pulled loose. The wires that came down, there was about a 3-foot segment that was cut and totally gone. So it turns out that this camera was in full view of one located slightly to the east. And as it looked at the incident, it just so happens, again, we know when it stopped. So as they looked at what was going on the ranch, it turned out that the cattle were kind of quietly milling around the pole. And what we knew is if anybody approached the cattle, they would scatter. And yet, during the time of all this ongoing incident, nothing happens. They just sat there. And you see nothing of all of this physical damage that took place that should have been seen on the other camera.
Well, Dr. Alexander, you have to have a hypothesis on what this is then. Do you think that this is something extraterrestrial, interdimensional, or is it high-tech stealth gear being used by, you know, our own military or another military branch?
Well, you can rule out the latter. I mean, that's okay. Just nonsense. If we had that, we wouldn't have near the problems
right
that we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan. No, what I wrote to is a concept that I came up watching this and other similar incidents. So what I called it was a precognitive sentient phenomena. And what I meant was that, what does this say yet? Whatever it is, and we don't know what it is, but there was definitely a phenomena that was absolutely in charge. When I say precognitive, it knew not only what was going to happen, but how we were going to respond to it. Certainly, it was sentient. It was very, very smart. And and phenomenological, of course, it goes along the lines of the trickster, which has appeared in basically all cultures. think of the, like I say, the Trickster or Coco Pelle or Pan, or, you know, name your imp type thing. But there was some ultra intelligence kind of entity, and I don't know if you're going to, is extra dimensional or what, but it was definitely in charge. And what would happen is we would get an incident like that, and we'd say, okay, well, now we'll study that, and you'd set up to do it, and it, the, they call it a PSP, says, oh, you like that one? Try this, and you would get something totally different, or it would happen just off camera, or, you know, in fun. But
what's it like then, John, to be in the presence of this, to know that there is something that powerful, that extraordinary? Is it exhilarating? Is it terrifying? Is it a mix of both?
No, again, remember that the incidents as we describe them, and there are many, many more, but these are amortized over a decade. What is unique about it is that you have a specific geographic location. If we get into UFOs, I think one of the problems there is you amortize some very dramatic events, but over, we'll take your pick, from decades to millennia, and over the globe. That's certainly a global phenomenon. So when you say that, I would say no more so than life itself. When you're coming to an understanding that, there are things that are greater than what we understand.
Have you ever come into a situation, and I know this will be tough because you're an ex-military man, but have you ever come into a situation with strange phenomena where you thought, oh, man, I'm in over my head on this one? There was a risk or a real threat involved?
By over your head. I certainly had many experiences where, I was not in control and did not understand or be able to explain the incidents that were happening. Well, we can talk about some of the ones with voodoo and that. But that these were fear-based, not necessarily. And again, I think it goes back to one's belief system. And I think some people would be fearful, but then, this is a fear-based society.
Right.
Fortunately, we try to scare people all the time from everything.
Well, it's easier to control the fearful, right?
Right.
Right. And I want to get into the UFO aspects of this, but I'm curious, too. And what I was kind of getting at is the fact that, you can go somewhere. I can go where Bonnie and Clyde held up a bank 80 years ago and feel like, wow, this is a historic location. I can go and stand over the USS Arizona and see the bubbles of oil still coming up from the ship and know that you're steeped in history and tragedy in that moment, but you're still removed from that aspect because it was so far in the past. It was so long ago. But to be in an environment like the Skinwalker Ranch, the NIDS Ranch up there, and know that there is phenomena taking place, even though it's not on a daily or hourly basis, knowing that you may be in the presence of something otherworldly, that even though it may not be vivisecting a cow in front of you or turning three dogs into grease spots, there is something powerful there that is concurrent, that is taking place in that moment, in that time that you are existing in that spot. That's what I was just curious. Is that ever kind of how does that, impact and affect somebody when you realize that this is going on? And as you said, these things had power, and you and the group there, unless, it's something you can't mention, you had very little that you could do to stop something if it decided to come through or do so, try to do to you what it did to the dogs.
Well, I don't think you can.
Okay.
But
you don't think
you
can stop it?
There are areas of the world that seem to concentrate such activity.
Mm-hmm.
I give you a totally different example and ones that I did have such a sensing.
Okay.
We were in Tibet and had gone to a monastery. People don't understand Tibet today at all, but and most have forgotten that early 1950s, you had the Chinese invasion that came across. And in this particular monastery, they had not done a lot of preparation. It does turn out that many, many of the artifacts and writings and things were protected, and that the people got together and went out and just packed them in sand, because altitude and very dry area, they were well preserved. But this particular one, I'd say we're around 15,000 feet high, and it had been particularly bad because the monks had believed that nothing would happen to them, and it turns out they got slaughtered. The Chinese had come in and just wiped out everybody that was there.
Right.
And I've got to say, that's one of those areas that I was in where you're sitting there and you're going, this just feels bad.
You know? Right.
You know, it had happened, in this case, you know, 5 decades earlier, but still, you know, the notion of a presence of evil or, you know, these terrible events that took place, you could feel it.
We are up against a break. I want to talk about some of the other phenomena. I also want to talk about the case of Chris Bledsoe when we return. And again, the book is out and available, Reality Denied, Firsthand Experiences with Things That Can't Happen But Did. John B. Alexander, PhD, our guest this evening. You can find a link to his book by visiting darknessradio.com. Click on our Killer Deals link. You'll find the book there. It's easy to order. Very accessible, so go check it out. We'll be back. We've got more coming your way right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to the show. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. Hey, listen, my intrepid travelers, if you are interested in putting yourself into the world of the strange and the supernatural, then join me this September as we go on our Dracula stakeout. We're returning to Romania and Transylvania. We're going to follow in the footsteps of Vlad the Impaler, the original Dracula. We'll hear his stories, his history. We'll visit his birthplace, his death place, his place where he fought battles, was imprisoned, and his own castle. We'll also have a chance to investigate two or three very well-known haunted and active hotspots, including, I believe it's called the Baisu Forest. And they have not only ghostly activity, but UFO activity on a regular basis. That's the first stop on our journey. And if you'd like to be a part of the adventure of a lifetime, it's real easy. You can go check out darknessevents.com. That's darknessevents.com. And then click on the Dracula banner, the Romania banner, and join us. You can go sign up for it now, make a deposit, and they can make payment. You can make payment plans on it. So that way you can be a part of the event with us, which will take place in September 2018. We're already more than half sold out on the trip. We'd love for you to join us. You can also email me, dave@darknessradio.com, and I will send you out that link so you can find it even easier. Reality Denied, that's the name of the book by our guest, John B. Alexander, PhD. And this is just the start of hopefully many visits. As he had mentioned, we could do an entire episode on each chapter of this book. And we've started with that now by discussing his first chapter, talking about the Skinwalker Ranch and the strange phenomena that is known to have taken place around there. I wanted to discuss with you now in this segment the case of Chris Bledsoe. And can you, for our listeners and myself that are not as familiar with the story, introduce us to Chris Bledsoe and his tale, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, this is a most remarkable case, but again, the subtitle of the book is First-Hand Experiences, so this is not just reporting on Chris, though some of it is. And I've got to admit, I had met him first, and I had heard this terribly intricate story that entails, again, multiple phenomena from UFOs, spontaneous healing, talk about the burning tree and some other things. And you listen to that, you go, you know, basically say, give me a break. You know, this just, I don't know how this could all be true. So anyway, I had a chance to go down and meet with him in Hope Mills in North Carolina, just south of Fayetteville. And delightful, I mean, he's very, very open. Unfortunately, he has been taken to task, I think, erroneously by some folks in the UFO community. But my firsthand experience, again, gets back to validation. So my wife and I were there, and we had spent a couple days. Family is very tight-knit, well-integrated, very supportive. They have taken a lot of heat, of course, because as elements of the story has gotten out, and it both scares people and is too phenomenological to be believed. But what happened was that the initial incident had taken place in January down on the Cape Fear River. And so Chris had explained to us how the events had happened. And what he described was that he and his family, or boys, went down and they were fishing with some friends. It got late, and being January, it was pretty chilly in North Carolina, and they built this big fire. And, you know, all the camaraderie was going on. So he said, well, I'm going to go up the hill, and it's 400 or 500 meters, but it rises gently as it moves away from the riverbank. And as he walks up the hill, he describes two big orange glowing orbs that are floating over this open field. Might describe the area is kind of where you transit between urban and rural. This particular area had open fields, but connects very quickly with some suburban area. He sees that and then disappears, and he comes back down to the fire to talk to people, and his truck has moved. The fire has almost died out, and he finds out that between 4 and 5 hours has disappeared. And everybody said, well, where were you? And he says, well, I just, you know, went up there. So we have a missing time. About that time, they have a number of UFOs that appear and come dropping in. It just scares the crap out of everybody. They throw all the gear in the back of the truck and go, you know, to go driving off. But Chris's son, Chris Jr., is missing. Finally locate him, and he is just scared crapless, hiding in the woods. And he describes I just call them creepy crawlers, some kind of quasi-mechanical-looking beast that had come through the forest chasing him. He describes them as eyes alternately blinking between right and left and whatnot. So anyway, that part of the story, like I said, we've got this missing time and whatnot. It scares the hell out of them, and they go home. Drop the people off, and then Chris thinks that there's somebody around. Here's dogs barking. By the way, the yard is quite big. It contains several acres. Goes outside, and then this beastie, sort of short, big head, spindly thing starts chasing him. And he runs off. And it chases him, and he's finally out of breath and can't go any farther. And it turns around, and he says, oh, you got me. And he says, telepathically, this entity says to him, "You don't understand. We're here to help." About that time, Chris Jr. comes up, entity disappears. So we'll fast forward now. I'm going to jump around a bit in this story, but it is so convoluted that it's hard to just do it totally sequentially. So, 11, I guess, we were there, and Chris took us down. It was late in the afternoon, and Victoria and his wife, or I'm sorry, Chris's daughter, and so there were four of us, went down to the river, and he showed us where everything had happened, and that's kind of interesting. Got back up, and by the time we got back to where the car was located, it's now getting dark. It's not pitch black, but it's really quite dark. And Victoria and his daughter get in the car, and they're discussing something. And so Chris and I are leaning against the left front fender, and he's, again, pointing out where things were. And all of a sudden he says, "Oh, I think they're here." And within about 10 seconds, this thing pops into view and goes zipping off. I mean, the significance here, of course, is the temporal relationship between him saying, "I think it's here," and this thing just popping into view. We'd watched planes, so we knew how they transited the area. This was not something that came in from outside. It just emerged into view, did not last long. But it is what I believe the second UFO sighting that I personally had. And I've got to say, that definitely got my attention.
Now, you've got a unique perspective. As having been ex-military, you know what a lot of our craft look like and have the capabilities to do, I'm sure, and understand a lot of this. When you're seeing something like this, is it fair for you to say that you believe this is not tech from our planet or not current aircraft from anybody here?
Was this of terrestrial origin? I can say definitely not. And again, it just popped into view, this bright thing. I can't really describe structure to it. And then it went zipping off. Didn't last long, but the significance was Chris stating, "I think they're here," and almost immediately that event happening.
Right, so he had a sense.
There's some other stuff happened. We can get into that. Some other things happened back at the house as well. But
all right. Well, that's so he had this sense that there was something. He knew there was a disturbance in the force, right? And he was right.
He maintains that he has continuous contact, or contacts that happen, intermediately, but on a frequent basis. Now, let me backtrack to one of the things that is really key to this. Remember, Alien had said, "We're here to help you." Well, it turns out Chris was a victim of Crohn's disease. And if you know, Crohn's is one of those very socially debilitating diseases, lasts for a long time. He had been on medicine for 12 years, trying to control the diarrhea, upset stomach, and all the things that go along with that. So the day following that incident, he's going along, and it's about noon, and he suddenly realizes, "Gee, I didn't take my medicine." And he has not taken it since. So basically he was cured of Crohn's disease instantaneously.
So a spontaneous healing taking place. I mean, with the Crohn's disease, there are markers, there are identifiers to tell you that this is what's going on. Has he had a full medical workup to say, yes, there's no...
Again, he had been he'd been a patient for 12 years.
Right.
He'd been on medicine. I mean, the whole etiology was definitely known and terminated spontaneously. And again, spontaneously, in relationship to the incident that he reports of talking to this sentient entity of some kind. Yeah, the entity did not say, remember, he didn't say, I'm here to cure you of Crohn's disease.
Right.
The telepathic messages were here to help. And he says that he didn't recognize it until later that, oh, I had not and have not taken the medicine. Now, there's more to the story that goes beyond that, but in relationship to healing. There's a very unique tree in his backyard, and the tree caught fire from the inside out, kind of a hollowed area. Now, normally, if trees are going to burn or get hit by lightning, you know, they burn from the outside in.
Right.
And this had, again, spontaneously caught fire. And there does seem to be a number of spontaneous healings related to that area. One of the things I asked Chris was whether it was, because these things follow, whether it was him or the area, and he thinks that the events follow him personally, and the area does have some effect. Now,
has he been forthcoming with why he believes that they selected him? Have the beings informed him of that, or?
No, I really don't know and can't speak to it. You ought to. He'd probably be a good guest to talk about.
Sounds like it. Yeah.
And because my initial interview with him, I put on tape, was like several hours because it just goes on and on and on. But again, because my firsthand experience, one, again, the temporal experience of being told that there something's here and seeing that. But we went back, and my wife is somewhat similar to what I described with Eric Davis earlier, is sensitive to these sorts of things. She's an ayahuasca devotee, and we've had a number of, you know, phenomenal incidents that's happened. And I have seen what happened. We're back at the house, walking out towards the tree, and I was walking behind Chris and Victoria, and they're talking. And I watched her go into, I call it kind of a dance. It's sort of like a quasi-trance sort of thing that I have seen on a number of occasions. I've seen it in voodoo ceremonies. I've seen it meeting with shamans in the Amazon and whatnot as well. And she will just tell you that there was something there. It's not an overt communication, but indication of information transference that was taking place with her.
And did she, I mean, to have that kind of experience, was this something she had been open to before, or was this a whole new revelation?
I have seen that. That's what I was saying. I have seen this on many occasions. Some really phenomenal, you know, incidents that are just as outlandish as what we're describing here. So this is hardly unique, but that's how I recognized it.
Talking with our guest, John B. Alexander, PhD, and we've been discussing some of these different cases. In discussing the UFOs and the experiences, how many experiences can you say you've actually had with Chris and his family?
Well, no, ours was that one few days that we were there. Well, actually, that's not true. Just reminded me. Actually, he was out here, and I live in Las Vegas, and a lot of folks don't know it, but we have, you know, Mount Charleston behind us, which is 12,000 feet high. So, with some friends, we were out screwing around late one night. We thought we would see if we could lure something in or get a response. So we were driving in a remote area. And the crossroad is about the 9,000-foot level. and had pulled off, and we were, what are they screaming around? We had balloons and attaching chem lights to them and sending it up, because we were told that the entities in the area liked entertainment like that. And so I'm sure some people did think they saw UFOs, that they were our balloons. But what was of interest is I took a number of pictures, flash photography, and one of the things I've noticed is that some of them are exactly, it was using flash, but exactly as you would anticipate, showing the people that were there, and others show orbs. I might mention that Chris frequently sends me pictures. I say these are ongoing phenomena, and he thinks that the orbs are either intelligent or under intelligent control, and gets photos of them. And I might mention some of them are in the visual spectrum, as well as things that seem to appear where you would expect to see them, but you don't.
I'm curious, being in the Vegas area, how long have you been there, John?
I'm going on 23rd year.
Okay. Were you familiar with a gentleman named Prophet Yahweh out in the Las Vegas area?
Vaguely, yes.
Okay. I was just curious if you had ever had any kind of encounters with him or what your thoughts were.
I have not, and I'm aware of some of the descriptions, but have never met, just more familiar with the folklore.
I know he's passed away now, I think a few years ago, but he had the ability, reportedly, to call these craft down, and one of your local news stations thought it was a lark, and they took him out to an undisclosed location. They chose the location. They chose the time. He began praying, and this silver ball starts to drop out of the sky. They caught it on film. That was what was so amazing to me. I mean, that was Las Vegas news. They're watching this unfold. And as you were talking about your story of how, you know, these things would just kind of make themselves known, I like I said, I was just curious, kind of running in that same realm, if he had ever crossed paths with you at all.
Well, are you familiar with Bob Monroe, the Monroe Institute?
Right, yes, okay.
Yeah, well, Bob was a friend of mine. The one that uses a hemisync, where they put one sound in one ear and a differential sound in the other and create a beat frequency and drive your brain. But, yeah, that's one of the things Bob used to do, was to go out and call UFOs down. So not a unique skill, and
but a pretty good one.
I'm sorry?
I said no, but it's a pretty good skill if you can do it.
Yeah.
Have you tried that yourself, calling these things forth?
Well, for your listeners, you want to say go out and try it, damned if sometimes it doesn't work.
Right. And, I mean, has there been any kind of, you know, I mean, Prophet Yahweh would pray for these things to make themselves known, that they were part of God's bigger plan. Have you, what seems to be successful ways for these things to show, or does it really not seem to have any rhyme or reason to this?
Yeah. I can tell you, I can give you a recipe for bending metal, but not for calling UFOs. Although, if you remember the men who stare at goats.
Right.
One of the classic incidents in that, the cloud busting. Yeah, we also used to really do that.
All right. Now, you mentioned goats, that. That's fascinating to me.
What I might mention is when Ronson, if there's any doubt, if you read the book, and I do not recommend it.
Right.
But in the book, we are mentioned by name, so there's no doubt who we are. But the problem is that he took a little bit of reality and stretched it into almost unrecognizable, and then they made the movie. But some of the things in there did happen, but goats did not die from being stared at.
Okay. Well, thanks for clearing that up, PETA. You don't have to write to me now. That story has been cleared up.
Well, goats did die.
What?
And are you familiar with Dim Mak?
No, I can't say that I am.
OK. Okay, this is in the martial arts known as the death touch.
Oh, okay, right. Now that I'm familiar with, the death touch, sure.
Denmark is the word for it, and that was what I know the people involved, I'm still in contact with several of them, but that is what they did. There was a goat lab at Fort Bragg, and the goat lab was there to teach medics how to deal with gunshot wounds, so that if a medic was trained, the first time he saw a gunshot wasn't, you know, with a human on the battlefield. And so they had taken some of the goats out, and Guy Savelli was the one who had taught the technique, and a couple other master sergeants were involved, hit the goat. And what you know is that with Dim Mak, it is not instantaneous. This is something where you're basically interrupting the flow of ki or chi throughout the body. If you understand those systems, death does occur very, very quickly at the time it occurs, but in the case of the goats, I think it was about 12 hours later, they had hit the goat, left it hobbled in front of time-lapse cameras, and just all of a sudden they went, and drops over, and saw the necropsy, which is most interesting and highly unusual.
That's just disrupting the energy pattern or energy flow of a creature or human.
Well, that's the interesting theory, but the thing that I point out, and again, I have a chapter on this in the book as well, but I saw the necropsy, and I don't know if you've ever seen somebody shot with a bullet or whatnot.
No.
But as the bullet goes through the body, the energy, you know, bullet's going forward, but energy radiates out from that point. What was interesting was across the thoracic region was a line of energy with spiral energy coming out of it that looked exactly like a bullet going across that region of the chest, but there was no wound of entrance or wound of exit.
That's unbelievable. If people have that kind of ability,
first-hand experiences with things that can't happen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's disturbing and terrifying to think that people have that ability. Again, reality denied. First-hand experiences with things that can't happen but did. John Alexander, our guest. We just have a few minutes left together. John, do you believe we are being visited by otherworldly or interplanetary beings, aliens?
Are we?
Yes.
Well, I actually come down against the ETH, or what's called the extraterrestrial hypothesis, i.e. little green guys from Zeta Reticuli or wherever. And the reason I'm against it is it does not fit the data, and it is simply too simple to a very, very complex set of phenomena. And, of course, the point is that we have reports of interactions between humans and sentient non-humans throughout the entirety of human history and in every culture. And the different shapes and sizes and whatnot. But, again, these beings seem to interact, and some of them obviously quite physically. And I think it's fairly recently, i.e. decades, if you will, that excuse me, that they suddenly showed up coming in little, tin aircraft.
Then where do you think all these strange encounters are coming from? Is there a genesis point for this? Bless you.
I don't know. And we're almost back to what we talked about, the precognitive sentient phenomena, that there is something there that is in control. And I do think that human consciousness is certainly a strong piece of it.
I'm curious, too, what your thoughts are, and I know we briefly touched on this, but with the Pentagon and the information that's coming out, and you know, it seems that there has been more and more of an effort from governments, from even religious leaders like the Pope saying, you know, it's okay to believe in life elsewhere, and that we are probably not the only species, the, you know, sentient beings that exist. Do you believe that we are being set up here for disclosure soon on what is really going on, or will this always be covert information that will never truly get acknowledged?
Well, I disagree with the premise, and I understand that it's popular and all of that. But, you know, Lou Elizondo's program that he ran was minuscule. I did the identical thing 30 years ago. I had a program that, you know, that I ran. I had members of all of the services, the intelligence community, aerospace, et cetera, et cetera. And the one big finding, I guess, was nobody's in charge. And I know the people from, you know, To the Stars, and I'm familiar with that. And they had the same thing, as I understand it, that Mattis, who's the Secretary of Defense, actually knew Lou, and they had had an encounter in Afghanistan. He found out maybe a couple of hours before the New York Times article hit. So I do not think there's any big central, you know, cabal who's, you know, hiding the information. I do think there are individuals who have interests, who have had experiences. I do know that's true. I mean, I know some of those people, but it gets back to where we basically started. Very much personality dependent. Are there people who are interested and willing to take it forward? That's the way my project started. I give him credit because he got funded. Mine did not, though we were at very, very high levels in the Pentagon. But similarly, we had the same arguments that came out that we discussed before, the religious issues of, I'll give you a specific example. I was briefing a very, very senior panel, and one of the individuals had been DDR&E, which is the Deputy Director for Research and Engineering, i.e. all the R&D aspects that goes on in the Pentagon. And I was retired at the time, and I gave the talk on, it was on UFOs specifically, and he asked if he got done, asked any questions, got a couple, and all of a sudden he went high order and just screamed at me. He said, "You're not supposed to know that. That's what you learn when you die." And
whoa.
Back, and I say, sorry, I thought we were in a science panel here. But it's an example.
A message,
of,
right?
Again, individual experience. You've had people who have individual positive experience, people who've seen UFOs, who have had encounters, who have had encounters with sentient beings. A number of those, more of those are coming to light, but it's all personality dependent. There is no, as far as I know, and this is a common agreement across, and one of the things I mention is that in my study, I'm the only one, and I think it's still true, who actually went and briefed either the head or the deputy of all of those three-letter agencies you think you know about, and some others. And the common factor was, well, I'll give you one who was the head of one of those three-letter agencies who said, A, we don't do that. There's no requirement for us to collect intelligence on that. But B, I'll tell you about the ones I saw. So the point was he had had a personal experience with seeing something flying around that he knew was beyond any capability that existed, certainly at that time. And yet, being in charge of the agency, said, we don't collect on that.
Fascinating stuff. John B. Alexander, PhD, Colonel John Alexander. Reality denied, firsthand experiences with things that can't happen but did. You can find that if you just visit darknessradio.com and click on our Killer Deals link. You'll find all of our authors there, all of the great books you hear covered on our show. And do me a favor, when you buy John's book and you read it, and there's so much more information. I mean, we've scratched the surface of just two of the chapters. There is so much great information in there. Do me a favor, when you buy the book, review it, give it 5 stars so we can get books like this printed. We can keep it out there. People can get educated, hear these great stories, and learn firsthand from the people that have investigated and experienced them on their own. John, thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to visiting again with you sometime in March and chatting about voodoo and ayahuasca and your experiences in Brazil. And you've got so much to share. Thank you for allowing us into your world.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. That's it for today, kids. We'll be back again tomorrow. And remember, if you missed yesterday's True Crime Tuesday, go subscribe right now. I know there's some hiccups at the beginning of each month, and some of you have to go back in and resubscribe, but just get in there and check out the new episode. It is it's really bizarre. It's all I can tell you. Talking about the death of Princess Diana, was it murder? Was it just an accident? The information that is brought to our attention is really interesting, fascinating points to consider, and you can check that out by going to darknessradio.com and click on the True Crime Tuesday banner to subscribe. That's it. We'll be back again tomorrow with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.